Chapter 6. A Memorial Containing a Summary View of Facts. Ay me, what perils do environ the man that meddles with cold iron. Samuel Butler, Hudibras. La Belle Riviere, so the French used to call the Ohio River, and in the mid-18th century they longed to make this beautiful river and the rich, fertile land it circumscribed a part of French North America. William Smith, the 18th century historian of New York, assessed the situation as he pondered the beginnings of the Seven Years' War in his Review of the Military Operations in North America. The French, jealous of the growth of the English colonies, were now meditating all possible arts to distress them and extend the limits of their own frontier. Reports of French incursions into the Ohio Valley filtered back to Williamsburg by 1754, riling Governor Dinwiddie so much he started recruiting troops to send west to defend British territory against the French and their Native American allies. The governor gave Joshua Fry, best known for the classes in mathematics and natural philosophy he taught at the College of William and Mary, command of the Virginia forces. Though this professor-turned-colonel had little military experience, Fry did have a superb knowledge of the land. 3 years earlier, he had collaborated with Peter Jefferson, Thomas's father, to create the most accurate and detailed map of Virginia to that time. Dinwiddie appointed George Washington to serve as Fry's lieutenant colonel. Before spring, Governor Dinwiddie learned that French troops were on the move and progressing more quickly than expected. He ordered Washington to assemble the men he had enlisted so far, pack the provisions he had gathered, and head westward. Fry would follow later, according to the governor's plan. For the time being, Washington would lead the campaign. He and his men left the last day of March, 1754. With all the recent rain, the creeks and streams and rivers spilled over their banks, forming dangerous obstacles for cross-country travel. The roads and trails were thick with clayey mud that stuck to every boot, hoof, and wagon wheel that passed. The movement of Washington's men was less a march than a slog. He recorded their slow pace in the notebook he brought along to chronicle the campaign. 2 months later, on May 28th, his forces engaged a French and Indian party led by Joseph Coulon du Villiers, Sieur de Jumonville. The British and French exchanged gunfire. This, Washington's first firefight, thrilled him to the core. As he famously said in a postscript to a letter he wrote his brother Jack 3 days later, "I can with truth assure you, I heard bullets whistle, and believe me, there was something charming in the sound." Jack shared the letter with friends, who enjoyed it so well they made copies of it. One person who got hold of a copy indiscreetly sent it to the London Magazine, which published the entire letter in its August issue, making George Washington a published author again. In its printed form, his letter found a wide readership in England. Even King George II read the London Magazine. Upon reading Washington's comment about the charming sound bullets made, the king remarked, "He would not say so if he had been used to hearing many." 15 minutes after it had begun, the skirmish was over. The Virginians had won, and Jumonville was dead. Washington's decision to engage the enemy might have been too sudden and too rash. Afterward, the French claimed their troops had been on a mission to deliver a peaceful warning. From the British perspective, Washington's action against the French threat was justified. According to one contemporary observer, Jumonville was slain in fair battle in open opposition to the English when he attempted to take their convoy. Jumonville's death had profound implications. It proved to be the spark that kindled the Seven Years' War. Commenting on the death of Jumonville a few years later, Voltaire quipped, So complicated are the political interests of the present times that a shot fired in America shall be the signal for setting all Europe together by the ears. The skirmish with Jumonville did not stop Washington's campaign. At Great Meadows, his men built a fort he christened Fort Necessity. Planning a second fort, he chose an ideal location on Redstone Creek. Before his troops could erect it, he learned that a much larger party of French and Indians under the command of Louis Coulon de Villiers, Jumonville's brother, was heading toward Fort Necessity, hell-bent on revenge. Around 1,200 men strong, the French and Indian parties sought dark justice for Jumonville's death. Washington and his men left Redstone Creek and returned to Fort Necessity, where they joined forces with James McKay's independent company of regulars. The presence of British regulars created some tension with the Virginia troops. From the colonial perspective, the regulars were paid too much for doing too little. Despite the animosity between British and colonial troops, Washington respected their leader. "A brave and worthy officer," he called McKay. Colonel Fry never did reach Fort Necessity. Having fallen badly from his horse, he perished the last day of May. George Washington, at 22, found himself commander of the Virginia Army. Despite his youth, Washington had a dominating presence. 6 feet tall and nearly 200 pounds, he cut a figure most men admired. When he was astride his horse, few could command greater respect. An accomplished equestrian, Washington inspired awe wherever he rode, even among such expert riders as Thomas Jefferson and the Marquis de Chastellux. Jefferson called him the best horseman of his age and the most graceful figure that could be seen on horseback. Chastellux used similar language. Washington was a very excellent and bold horseman, leaping the highest fences and going extremely quick without standing upon his stirrups, bearing on the bridle, or letting his horse run wild. The Battle of Great Meadows did not allow Washington to demonstrate his equestrian skills. Instead, he and his men were pinned down inside the poorly designed Fort Necessity. The battle began as the French attacked the fort on July 3, 1754. Fierce fighting continued all day. By nightfall, Washington sadly realized the French had the Anglo-American forces greatly outmanned and outgunned. He prudently decided to surrender. William Smith, who considered him a young gentleman of great bravery and distinguished merit, explained, "Colonel Washington, observing the great superiority of the enemy, who now began to hem him in on all quarters, found himself under an absolute necessity of submitting to the disagreeable terms that were offered him." Smith's choice of words was inadvertent. At least one hopes he was not punning on the name of the fort when he mentioned the grim necessity of submission. Washington and McKay signed articles of capitulation, but unbeknownst to them, a devilish detail concerning Washington's campaign had been altered in translation. Coulon de Villiers tricked him into signing a document admitting he had deliberately assassinated Sieur de Jumonville. John Husk called these articles of capitulation the most infamous a British subject ever put his hand to. A Boston merchant living in London, Husk scarcely masked the disdain he felt toward the Virginia native in command. Such regional bias would dog Washington throughout his military and political career. From the time he and his men had left Alexandria until a week before the French attack, Washington had diligently maintained a journal, which somehow ended up in the hands of the French. Perhaps they forcibly took it from him. Perhaps they confiscated it with other official British papers. Or perhaps Washington accidentally left it behind when he evacuated Fort Necessity. Regardless how they obtained it, the French understood its propaganda value. they could use his journal to justify their aggression against the British on the American frontier. Only a few French officers scrutinized Washington's journal at first, but it gradually found its way into print and caught the attention of the French and English reading public. French military commanders also recognized that Washington's journal contained useful information about their Anglo-American enemy. They sent the manuscript to Montreal, where translators prepared at least two different French versions of the journal, and scriveners made multiple copies to distribute to other colonial officials. Baron du Longueuil, Lieutenant Governor of Montreal, received one. Marquis Duquesne, the Governor of New France, received another. After reading it closely, Duquesne sent an abridged version to his subordinate, the Sieur de Contrecoeur, commander at Fort Duquesne. In a lengthy cover letter dated the second week of September 1754, Governor Duquesne lambasted Washington. "You will see that he is the most impertinent of men, but that he is as clever as he is crafty with credulous savages. Besides, he lies a great deal in order to justify the assassination of Sieur de Jumonville, which has recoiled upon him, and which he was stupid enough to admit in his capitulation." The crotchety Duquesne could hardly suppress a sneer as he thought about Washington, who represented what he viewed as characteristic British duplicity. Duquesne also had some snide remarks for the Iroquois, calling them hypocrites for first promising to help the Virginians and then abandoning them when they needed help the most. As the short-sighted Duquesne read Washington's journal, he could hardly imagine the French would have difficulty conquering Anglo-American forces. To him, the journal read like a chronicle of dissension. The colonial American troops seemed ill-prepared, ill-equipped, and ill-suited to wage war on the French. Duquesne indulged his fancy in the cover letter to Contrecoeur. He imagined reading the journal in Washington's presence at the moment of his surrender. "There is nothing more unworthy and lower, or even blacker, than the opinions and the way of thinking of this Washington. It would have been a pleasure to read his outrageous journal to him right under his nose." In the coming months, Duquesne apparently read Washington's journal over and over again. It became something of an obsession for him, even affecting how he interpreted the changing seasons. In a letter to Contrecoeur the following March, for example, Duquesne characterized the time of year as "the season when Mr. Washington had the most troubles and hardships because of the floods." Though he scoffed at the leader of the Virginia troops, Duquesne was obviously moved by Washington's words. After returning home from his defeat at Fort Necessity, Washington looked forward to getting back to the battlefield and advancing his military career as war between Great Britain and France escalated. His status as a colonial subject hindered his progress. Having served as both lieutenant colonel and commander of the Virginia forces, he learned the British government now barred colonial officers from holding a rank higher than captain, regardless of their previous service. Washington resigned his commission, to the dismay of General Edward Braddock, commander-in-chief of the British forces in America. Braddock recognized Washington's military capabilities and asked him to serve as his aide. Washington accepted the position but stubbornly refused to take a reduction in rank or a cut in pay. Instead, he arranged to serve as a volunteer with neither rank nor pay. In the spring of 1755, Braddock led an expedition to gain control of the forks of the Ohio River. As he and his men neared Fort Duquesne in early July, Washington warned the general that the French fought differently in America than they did in Europe, and urged him to attack Indian style. Though Braddock had recruited Washington as his aide, he was strangely reluctant to take his advice. Dr. Alexander Hamilton, the witty Annapolis physician, not to be confused with Washington's future Secretary of the Treasury, interviewed some of the officers who had accompanied the expedition. Dr. Hamilton described Braddock's behavior as austere and supercilious, his temper haughty and imperious. Braddock, Hamilton continued, was only barely civil from the teeth outwards to Major George Washington, one of his aides-de-camp, a youth of an undaunted and brave spirit whose deserts are beyond my expression. Washington had held the rank of colonel at Fort Necessity, but he now held no rank. That Hamilton called him a major indicates how firmly the Journal of Major George Washington had established his soldierly reputation. Braddock planned to fight in rigid formation, the way the British had fought and won in the past. His outspoken aide offered to lead the provincial troops separately, so they could, in Washington's words, engage the enemy in their own way. Braddock met the offer with scorn, and on July 9, 1755, promptly led the British and colonial troops to slaughter. The bloodshed was at least partly caused by Braddock's refusal to accept Washington's advice. Retelling the history of the Seven Years' War soon after a peace had been reached, Oliver Goldsmith attributed the tragedy to Braddock's refusal to employ irregulars on the flanks of his army, or to scour the country through which he was to march. During the Battle of the Monongahela, as the conflict became known, the French forces and their Indian allies ambushed the British, killing hundreds of men, including many officers. Braddock himself was mortally wounded, as Dr. James Craik sadly realized while attending the general in his final moments. Craik, having already served under Washington at Fort Necessity, was becoming a good friend. Their friendship would last a lifetime. Washington escaped injury at the Battle of the Monongahela, though he had two horses shot from beneath him, and though, in Dr. Hamilton's words, his upper coat was almost shot to tatters with musket balls. Washington guided the surviving troops to safety. On July 17th, Washington, Craik, and the other survivors reached Fort Cumberland, Maryland, where Washington heard a rumor about his own death. Worried the rumor might reach home before him, he wrote his brother Jack, taking a light-hearted tone to let him know he was all right. "As I have heard since my arrival at this place a circumstantial account of my death and dying speech, I take this early opportunity of contradicting the first and of assuring you that I have not, as yet, composed the latter." Washington's letter to his brother follows a tradition of American humor established by Captain John Smith. From the founding of the Jamestown colony a century and a half earlier, dark humor had been an early American coping strategy, a defense mechanism useful for enduring otherwise unendurable horror. Washington's sense of humor helped him cope with the tremendous bloodshed and loss of life he encountered at the Battle of the Monongahela. By no means could his sense of humor efface the horror from his memory. 3 decades later, he could still see the carnage in his mind's eye. In an unguarded moment, Washington vividly recalled, "The shocking scenes which presented themselves in this night's march are not to be described. The dead, the dying, the groans, lamentation, and cries along the road of the wounded for help, for those under the latter descriptions endeavored from the first commencement of the action, or rather confusion, to escape to the 2nd Division, were enough to pierce a heart of adamant. The gloom and horror of which was not a little increased by the impervious darkness occasioned by the close shade of thick woods, which in places rendered it impossible for the 2 guides which attended to know when they were in or out of the track, but by groping on the ground with their hands." The exquisite lyricism of this text, regardless of its horrific imagery, suggests that Washington had mulled over the episode time and time again, refining his memory, trying to come to terms with what had happened. Beginning with the trope of the indescribable, he nonetheless attempts to describe what had happened. A catalog of gut-wrenching images and sounds follow. Linked together with a series of dashes, they have a stutter-step quality. The horrors occur in succession, yet without being coherently connected. Using the deliberate correction, action, or rather confusion, Washington conveyed his ongoing uncertainty about the situation. Years after the event, he was still grappling with how to express the bloody loss of life. His figurative language elevates his description to a kind of poetry, albeit a dark and disturbing kind. He ends with an absurdist image worthy of Samuel Beckett, depicting the guides mired in such obscurity they must grope their way through the darkness with their hands outstretched before them. Soon after the tragic event, Washington parceled out praise and blame. In a letter to Governor Dinwiddie, he expressed his appreciation of the British officers who, in general, behaved with incomparable bravery. He had greater praise for the Virginia troops, who, he famously said, behaved like men and died like soldiers. Unlike Dr. Hamilton and other contemporary commentators, Washington did not critique General Braddock. But he did come down hard on the British regulars, who broke and run as sheep before hounds, leaving the artillery, ammunition, provisions, baggage, and in short everything, a prey to the enemy. Seeking to rally the British troops in order to regain the ground they had lost and recover the equipment, Washington and his supporters had, he wrote, as little success as if we had attempted to have stopped the wild bears of the mountains or rivulets with our feet, for they would break by in spite of every effort that could be made to prevent it. Washington's role in the battle earned him the praise of his contemporaries. The Reverend Samuel Davies, for one, called him a heroic youth. Alluding to Washington's perilous escape from the battle, Davies prophesied, "I cannot but hope Providence has hitherto preserved in so signal a manner for some important service to his country." With Braddock's death, Governor William Shirley of Massachusetts became commander-in-chief of the British forces in America, and he shifted the focus of the war to Canada, a decision that left the Virginia frontier open to attack. The House of Burgesses passed legislation creating a conscript army of up to 2,000 troops and appointed Washington colonel of the Virginia Regiment and commander-in-chief of all Virginia forces. Despite Washington's burgeoning military expertise, his troops could do little to stop the Indian raids along the frontier. Adding to his frustration, Washington encountered further difficulties regarding the relative rank of British and colonial officers. As commander of the Virginia forces, he depended on Fort Cumberland as a strategic outpost, but a British captain there claimed to outrank Colonel Washington, arguing that an officer's commission in the regular British Army trumped an officer's commission in the colonial army, regardless of rank. The governor of Maryland supported the captain. Washington protested. So did Governor Dinwiddie. The matter was referred to Governor Shirley. When correspondence proved fruitless, Washington took drastic measures. He rode from Virginia to Boston on horseback in February 1756 to plead his case. The journey brought him through Philadelphia and New York on his way to Boston, places he had never visited before, and gave him a broad perspective on colonial America, a perspective that would serve him well in the coming years. Shirley invalidated the captain's commission and made Colonel Washington the ranking officer in Maryland. Shirley's actions fixed the problem in Washington's case, but did not solve the ongoing conflict between the relative rankings of British and colonial officers. For the rest of 1756 through the following year, Washington served as commander of the Virginia and Maryland troops on the frontier. He continued to hone his military skills and develop his administrative abilities. As the French waged war against the British in the North American wilderness, French propagandists did their part to justify the conflict in print, Jacob Nicolas Moreau taking the lead role in this regard. As a political propagandist, Moreau had only recently come to the fore. From his perspective, current political and religious challenges to the French monarchy threatened both public authority and social order. Moreau took it upon himself to defend absolute royal power in the face of these threats. A pamphlet he had published in 1755 defending royal authority as the basis of political and social order attracted the attention of the French crown. Consequently, Moreau became a paid propagandist for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He was assigned the task of pleading the case of France against England in the Seven Years' War. Moreau's defense of French monarchical authority, both during and after the war, earned him the title of Royal Historiographer. When a manuscript copy of Washington's journal reached Moreau's hands, he chose to include it in Mémoires contenant les précis des faits avec leur précise justificative, 1756, a work issued by the French government as propaganda to explain the reasons for the rupture between France and Great Britain and to urge support for the war. According to one recent historian, Moreau's version of Washington's journal constituted an unofficial codicil to France's formal declaration of war, a testimony to the justice of France's cause. Initially released in quarto as an official government document, Moreau's memoir was republished in less expensive, smaller format editions for the French reading public. Reprinted at The Hague later that year, it was disseminated across Europe. Washington unwittingly found himself a published author again. Given the way Moreau treated his journal, its publication cannot be considered a distinction. Since Washington's original diary does not survive, the French translations are the only known versions of it, allowing for a number of deliberate omissions and for what naturally gets lost in translation. Washington's editors agree that the fullest known translation roughly coincides with what Washington wrote. The greatest damage Moreau did to Washington's journal was not in translation, but annotation. Moreau read it much as Duquesne had, and his footnotes reflect his derogatory attitude. Overall, Moreau used his annotations to undermine what Washington had written, twisting his words to make them say whatever Moreau wished them to say. Quoting one letter signed Contocarius, Moreau asserted that Washington used this Indian name to endear himself to the people he intended to delude. Moreau made this assertion without knowing what Contocarius meant or how Washington gained the name. Actually, the name was not necessarily flattering. As Washington later told David Humphreys, Half King had given him the name during his diplomatic mission to Fort Leboeuf in 1753. It means town eater. Half King did not necessarily sense any town gobbling predilections in George Washington. He had given him the name because it was the Indian name of his great grandfather, John Washington. In the Native American oral tradition, the Washington family remained well known, and its genealogy was preserved as part of the communal memory. Known as Contocarius among the North American Indians, George Washington had little choice when it came to signing documents intended for a Native American audience. He signed his letter this way simply to identify, not endear, himself to the Indians. Elsewhere in his journal, Washington had explained that Governor Shirley would send 600 troops to harass the French in Canada. Though Shirley's action represented a strategic decision to shift the war from the backcountry of Pennsylvania and Virginia to Canada, Moreau interpreted it as a general indication of the bellicose nature of the British, expressing himself in feigned amazement in another footnote, "Behold the English always attacking." At a place in the text where Washington cited Half King as the authority for the warlike intentions of Jumonville's party, Moreau placed a note questioning the statement's authority. Washington had clearly attributed his information to Half King. Moreau's annotation denies the authority of the Native American voice. Copies of Moreau's memoir reached the American Strand toward the end of 1756. One was found on board a French vessel captured by a British privateer and brought to St. Kitts. A gentleman from there brought it to New York. Soon afterward, British privateers seized another French vessel, on which they found several more copies of Moreau's memoir. Philadelphia publisher James Chatton and New York publishers Hugh Gain and the firm of James Parker and William Wayman agreed to sponsor a translation, which they would jointly publish by subscription. Issuing a broadside dated January 29, 1757, announcing the translation and soliciting subscribers, Chatton advertised his edition before the New York publishers advertised theirs. His expedience created some tension between them. Describing the volume's contents in his proposal, Chatton let potential subscribers know that it would contain what he called the Journal of Major Washington. Calling him a major in his proposal, Chatton reinforces the impact of Washington's earlier work, The Journal of Major George Washington. Washington's exploits on the frontier had already helped create a name for him beyond the borders of Virginia. As Christopher Gist told him around that time, "Your name is more talked of in Pennsylvania than any other person of the army." The month after Chatton published his broadside advertisement soliciting subscribers for the book, Washington came to Philadelphia. His purpose was pragmatic. He sought an audience with John Campbell, 4th Earl of Loudoun, the new commander-in-chief of the British forces in North America. The precise date of Washington's arrival is unknown, but his accounts show that on February 24, 1757, he subscribed to Chatton's Philadelphia edition of Moreau's memoir. Lord Loudoun was notorious for keeping people waiting. Benjamin Franklin would tell a story about coming in to see Loudoun one day and meeting a messenger who was waiting on his lordship. When Franklin returned to see Loudoun 2 weeks later, he met the same messenger again and welcomed him upon his return. The man replied, "Returned? No, I am not gone yet." Loudoun would not reach Philadelphia until nearly 3 weeks after Washington, who consequently had plenty of extra time on his hands. The French edition of Moreau's memoir made Washington uneasy. Aware it contained information about his conduct, he grew anxious to read it, so anxious he could not wait until the English edition appeared. He felt helpless not knowing what was in the book. Washington obtained a copy of the French text and hired a translator to render into English both his journal and the French account of the battle at Fort Necessity. The translator completed his task the third week of March, when Washington paid him. Having learned about the forthcoming translation of Moreau's memoir, an unknown correspondent wrote to ask Washington's opinion of the volume. Washington responded with some comments on the text of what was supposedly his journal. "In regard to the journal, I can only observe in general that I kept no regular one during that expedition. Rough minutes of occurrences I certainly took, and find them as certainly and strangely metamorphosed. Some parts left out, which I remember were entered, and many things added that never were thought of. The names of men and things egregiously miscalled, and the whole of what I saw Englished is very incorrect and nonsensical." With confidence in the Philadelphian he had hired to translate the text of his journal back into English, Washington held the French translator and editor accountable for the errors introduced to his text. His comments about the journal represent Washington's first known critical remarks on his own writing. referring to his journal as rough minutes of occurrences, he was being modest. So far, his writing skills had improved with every journal he had kept. Regardless of his modesty, Washington took great pride in his writing and hated to see it mangled. He had an excellent memory and recalled some things he had written in his journal that the French had omitted. These omissions clashed with his penchant for precision. Washington disliked seeing all the details he had so carefully recorded, so carelessly ignored. Chatton stayed ahead of Gaine throughout the book's production. By the first week of June, Chatton had issued a handsomely printed octavo edition of the work. It proved to be one of his most distinguished imprints. He later fell on hard times and left the printing business. When Chatton's edition appeared, Gaine had yet to finish printing the New York edition. To make his belated edition more marketable, Gaine undercut Chatton's price, advertising that the forthcoming book would be considerably cheaper than the Philadelphia edition. Early American consumers were often willing to forego first editions for cheaper ones issued later. The firm of Parker and Wayman did not print its own edition, but instead issued sheets from Gaine's edition with a different title page. All three shared the same title: A Memorial Containing a Summary View of Facts with Their Authorities, in answer to the observations sent by the English ministry to the courts of Europe. Washington's journal was also republished in England and Ireland. A London edition of Moreau's memoir appeared in late 1757. Copies of the American translation may have reached England before the British edition appeared, but London publisher William Bizet independently commissioned an English translation, which he issued as The Conduct of the Late Ministry, or A Memorial, containing a summary of facts with their vouchers in answer to the observations sent by the English ministry to the courts of Europe. Washington's journal also appeared as an appendix to the Dublin edition of William Smith's Review of the Military Operations in North America. British readers received the conduct of the late ministry with indignation. While admitting the French had a right to publish whatever they wished to publish, they saw no reason why French propaganda should be imposed upon English readers. The Monthly Review wondered, "What business have we to strengthen their efforts and extend the circulation of their sophistry by the additional aid of our own language?" With a sigh of relief, the reviewer concluded that the work would not make any English readers sympathetic to the French cause, and dismissed the volumes with a few brief comments. The Critical Review devoted more space to the conduct of the late ministry, but its conclusions were much the same as those of the Monthly Review. According to the Critical Review, the documents that constituted the book simply did not prove what its French compiler wanted them to prove. The reviewer saw through Moreau's obfuscatory annotations. Since the documents themselves did not say what Moreau wanted, he annotated them to suit the purpose of propaganda. The Critical Review concluded with the hope that an enterprising British author would refute the book. No book-length refutation came forth, but the publishing history of George Washington's journal does not stop with the first issue of the London edition of Moreau's memoir, which was reissued 2 years later under a more captivating title, The Mystery Revealed, or Truth Brought to Light. According to its complete title, which is so long that it threatens to nudge its outermost letters off the edges of the title page, the work presented extraordinary facts relating to the conduct of the late ministry, supported by authentic papers and memoirs that neither confidence can outbrave nor cunning invalidate. As if the provocative subtitle were insufficient, the title page also contained a menacing Latin motto, Monstrum Horrendum. These words come from Virgil's description of Polyphemus in the Aeneid, a monster dreadful, misshapen, huge, whose sight was destroyed. The Latin phrase was often used as shorthand to express the dreadful, hideous nature of any monstrous thing. The book's sensational title is representative of the typical output of its publisher, who also issued such cheap, bawdy novels as The Reformed Coquette and Adventures of a Rake. In short, The Mystery Revealed was just another cheap book issued to generate some quick cash for its publisher. The Monthly Review was not fooled by this meretricious product, commenting, "Here we too have a mystery to reveal and a truth to bring to light, for this pamphlet is itself an errant imposition on the public. Monstrum horrendum is the motto to this pretended revelation, and monstrum horrendum say we, when we reflect on the ars meretricii of these literary midwives. The present publication being no other than a vamped-up title page to an old pamphlet first published in 1757. The words George Washington wrote on a wilderness trail had found their way to Grub Street.